£4 million in 2017, boasted a Canadian firm's London-based subsidiary, Concordia Investment Holdings UK Limited. This firm paid no income tax over the period, instead claiming tax credits worth a combined £42 million. It was able to do so in part because it made significant losses over the 3 years, partly due to £344 million in debt interest that it paid on £1.47 billion in loans that carried an interest rate of 10.5%. As well as paying the Jersey entity hundreds of millions of pounds in interest, Concordia Investment Holding UK also paid its dividends worth a combined £65 million. Concordia Healthcare changed its name to Advanced Pharma in 2018. Over the 8-year period covered by the CMA's fine for inflating drug prices, Advanced Pharma also handed significant payouts to senior managers. A subsidiary paid directors, who never numbered more than 3 people, about £21 million over the period of the drug price inflation. Spokesperson for Advanced Pharma claimed, "We are committing to the principles of openness and transparency in all our dealings with all applicable authorities, including all tax authorities." The spokesperson added, "The payment of dividends by a UK company to a Jersey company does not carry a tax benefit for any party, since dividends are not tax deductible for the UK payer in any circumstances. Under UK tax law, no tax is required to be withheld from dividends paid by a UK company, regardless of who receives the dividend, and dividends are not taxable on receipt in both the UK and Jersey. Given this, the dividends did not create a tax benefit." The spokesperson claimed, "The level of interest deducted by CIH UKL, Concordia Investment Holding UK, for UK tax purposes, is in accordance with the law, and HMRC has agreed our taxes for the period." On Thursday, 26th of July, the Competition and Markets Authority, CMA, said it had fined Advanced Pharma, its subsidiaries Cinven and HG Capital, a combined £100 million. Advanced Pharma was fined almost £41 million, while HG Capital and Cinven will pay penalties of £8.6 million and £51.9 million respectively. The Competition and Markets Authority, CMA, found in 2017 that Advanced Pharma had taken advantage of limited competition in the market to bring in sustained price hikes for leothyronine of more than 6,000% in the space of just 10 years. The repeated price increases led NHS spending on the tablets to soar from £600,000 in 2006, before the price increase strategy was implemented, to more than £2.3 million by 2009, as much as £30 million by 2016. The leothyronine tablets were placed on the NHS drop list in July of 2015, causing many people who relied on the drug to face the prospect of stopping treatment, paying for the drug themselves, or relying on inferior treatments. HG Capital declined to comment.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah. Today's great tip: what are the secrets of Ubudiyya the secrets of the worship of Allah in the words of the esteemed Imam Khomeini. Now, dear listeners, we're talking about the secrets of ubudiyyah, the secrets of worship and servitude of Allah, and most especially in the esteemed words of Imam Khomeini. Imam Khomeini writes in one of his books that happily one will succeed in finding his way to the real ascension, the real ma'raj, through the guidance of the people of knowledge, the Ahl al-Ma'rifa, and he will succeed, she will succeed, who can tear off their heart from this dark dungeon and head towards the original destination of humanity, which is Allah. The road which has been taken by great prophets and noble men, holy men, the awliya of Allah, and the people of Allah, Ahlullah, and to which they invited others towards. Dear friends, the secrets of ubudiyyah, the secrets of the servitude of Allah, can be found first and foremost, as is said, in tearing off, detaching, removing our heart from this dark dungeon called and named the materialistic world. We must cut off our relations from this dark dungeon, this prison, this cage, this materialistic world of greed and carnal desires and power and status and wealth and dominion and domination. Our heart cannot become attached to these things if we really want to taste the beautiful and sweet flavor of the servitude of Allah. We must do our best, dear friends, to head towards the original destination of humanity, as it is said in the Holy Quran, and as Imam Hussein alayhi salam said, "Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un." The original, the ultimate, the real destination of humanity is Allah Subhanahu wa ta'ala, the mighty, the exalted. And this path, dear friends, this path which is called Sirat al-Mustaqim, the straight path, is the path and the road which the Ahl al-Ma'rifa have taken, the people of knowledge, the awliya Allah have taken, the holy, pious people of Allah, and the Ahlullah have taken. In these secrets of ubudiyyah.
Ya muqalliban qulub, thabbit qalbi ala dinik. Ya muqalliban.
Dear listeners of the program Foresight, my name is Muhammad. Today I'm going to read to you the English translation of an excerpt from Munajatul Arifin. Please stay with me. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. My God, tongues fall short of attaining praise of you proper to your majesty. Intellects are incapable of grasping the core of your beauty. Eyes fail before gazing upon the glories of your face, and you have assigned to your creatures no way to know you, save incapacity to know you.
Welcome back to your listeners in continuation to what we were talking about, which was the secrets of Ubudiyah, the secrets of the servitude of Allah, in the esteemed words of Imam Khomeini, and how we find that in one of these places it is related that we need to tear off and detach our hearts from this dark dungeon, this dark cave, this small cage called the materialistic world. We also talked about how this path of tearing off your heart from this world and subsequently connecting it to Allah is the path that the people of knowledge, the people of Allah, the lovers and followers and obeyers of Allah have taken throughout time. Continuing, we find that in one of these places it has been written that the veils of desire and negligence, Imam Khomeini writes, has blocked our insight from the most beautiful of beauties, that which is of Allah. And the heavy curtains of loving this materialistic world and the devilry and seduction and deception of this materialistic world has secluded, isolated, and alienated our hearts from attending to the glory of the majesty of Allah. Dear friends, again, how beautiful, how profound. Desires, carnal desires, selfish desires, greedy desires, jealous desires, desires for the materialistic world, desires for money and power and wealth and status. These are veils, curtains, barriers, hurdles, obstacles that have blocked our insight and the vision and the ears and the eyes of our heart and our soul from witnessing the most beautiful and amazing and majestic beauty of Allah. The secrets of the servitude of Ubudiyah, the secrets of Ubudiyah itself. We need to remove these veils and these curtains of these carnal desires and this negligence, this ignoring the reality which is Allah, if we want to witness the beauty and the glorious grandeur of the mighty Allah. It is these heavy curtains, dear friends, of loving this world, and it is the deception and the mirage and the fake superficial glamour of this world which alienates our hearts, kills our hearts, starves to death our hearts from attending and realizing and witnessing and feeling the glory and the majesty and the beauty and the awesomeness of Allah. And so if we are to increase and enhance our ubudiyah, our servitude, our worship, our obedience of Allah, we must cut off our heart from this materialistic world and cut off our heart from the veils of desire and negligence and move towards the most beautiful of all beauties and the most glorious of all majesties, Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. And now we will listen to Sheikh Zayd As-Salami, who will talk about today's topic.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Prior to me adopting a belief system, I need to choose a worldview. I need to make sure that this worldview falls in line with what it is that I am doing on this earth. A worldview means I understand where I came from, what is my purpose in this world, where I will be going. It's to have a good direction. It's to understand what life is. It's to make sure that I realize my responsibility and get to the goals and objectives that I have. And it all rotates around creation and trying to get a grasp onto why I am living. Me being created by the divine entity, by God Almighty. When I understand that through Tawheed, through monotheism, through inspiration from the likes of such great personalities like the Holy Prophets and the Imams, that worldview will be so strong and firm, it will keep me on that right path that I wish to be on. If I make sure that I am accountable and responsible for absolutely everything that I do, I will be loyal and committed to the meaning of this life. I'll make sure that I don't harm others. I'll make sure that I'm always good and nice and kind. Why? Because I know that there is a judgment day that will be coming. That's a part of my worldview. Accountability. That's the first thing that is very, very important for me to understand and implement in my practical life. Being responsible and being accountable. Know that there is a hisab and a kitab that will be waiting for me once I depart this very short life of mine. Number two is to guide myself and to guide others. Be a lantern of guidance and guide yourself and guide others towards these sacred objectives and goals to live a meaningful life. And number three, to make sure that we are vibrant and active and positive and lay down very good, productive precedents that will be used not only for us in this lifestyle, in this world that we live in, but also for future generations, for those who are after us. Leave a good legacy behind us. That is what my religion teaches me. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Ilahana ma'adalak malika kun liman malak labayka qad labaytu lak.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
سبحانه ما أعظم والملك لا شريك له لبيك إن الحمد لك والعز لا شريك
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Agent Orange, a chemical cocktail that became notorious as a defoliant, was used in aerial bombardments against the Viet Cong in the Vietnam War. The U.S. military sprayed millions of gallons of Agent Orange onto Vietnam's jungles during the conflict to expose northern communist troops. 40 years since the end of the war, people in Vietnam with severe mental and physical disabilities still feel the lingering effects of Agent Orange. Its legacy of death and deformity is well documented. Cancer and birth defects amongst both Vietnamese and U.S. veterans have been linked to exposure to the defoliant. But what is less known is how Agent Orange was used after the war. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. Agent Orange is made up of the chemicals 245T and 24D. In the 1960s and 70s in Australia, the solution used in weed eradication often involved the spraying of herbicides 245T and 24D with terrifying consequences. Sprayers were often exposed to the deadly poison without any protective gear. Many sprayers died young, one after another. But still, this is not the full extent of the problems caused by the chemicals. Stay with us as we meet the families of former government employees who have died almost certainly as a result of their exposure.
One-year-old Nigel Sinclair is in the last stage of terminal cancer. Nigel and his family believe he's soon to be the latest legacy from a chemical exposure which they say has killed his father, his uncle, and many of their mates. Before Nigel dies, he wants to know how a tragedy like this could happen.
At this very late stage, what would be the very best outcome for you?
It's like answers, really, just to someone that I can rest, and I can rest, and my family can rest, and put it to rest.
I'm lucky that he's still with us and still going. He has his moment where he'd like to have his closure.
Back in the 1970s and 1980s, hundreds of men were employed by the various state governments around the country to spray noxious weeds. Today, many are sick and many are dead.
A lot of the boys end up being the same, fading away near enough to nothing. Doctors turn and just, feed your medication, kill the pain. You're right, you'll be right.
Nigel's father was one of about 320 men in the West Australian Kimberley who sprayed herbicides for the state's Agriculture Protection Board, or APB. Now, there are reports of the sprayer's partners and children getting sick.
I think that they should have a close look epidemiologically and clinically at the children of those APB workers. I think that they should suspect that they'll have huge problems to deal with.
Mr. Hunter, Nigel's father, was one of many Indigenous men who joined the government spraying teams.
They'd work from sun up to sundown for what pay they got, little knowing that they're going to die later on in later years.
What the men didn't know was the herbicides they were spraying from backpacks were the same chemicals used to make Agent Orange in the Vietnam War. 245T and 24D, which were contaminated with dangerous dioxins.
Poison was carried on the same vehicle as their water drums and their swags and everything. They used to get soaked with the poison. They slept in it, worked in it for 10 days at a time. And all their clothes will get washed at home.
It wasn't an accidental spill on any work day. Their bodies were exposed to the herbicide all day, and I'm not talking about 8 hours in the day, but 24 hours a day, every week, for months and years. I can't conceive of anywhere where the exposure has been so intense and at such a level and for so long.
One of the workers, Carl Drysdale, said they would cart the drums of chemicals in the back of a four-wheel drive. The sprayers would go into the bush for 10 days at a time. For the first few years, the men were given no protective clothing.
Most of the people would be wearing what was appropriate for the heat, which would be shorts and thongs and T-shirts, you know.
A few years after spraying the chemicals, many of the men began to get sick.
Now, in the beginning, what were you told about the chemicals? How safe were they?
Harmless. So harmless you could drink it.
That's what they told you?
That's right.
Who told you that?
Oh, all the bosses, all the head shrinks.
But Carl Drysdale, who was the foreman, felt responsible for his men, and he was getting worried.
They all got rashes, everybody got rashes, headaches, and I guess internal bleeding was another pretty universal thing, like they were vomiting blood and passing blood.
Carl wrote to his superiors in June 1982 about his concerns. A manager from the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board wrote back saying that 245T was not considered dangerous if used as recommended, and that he did not support staff undertaking their own research.
You're told that the stuff's harmless, so you think, well, you know, I'm probably wrong, so you give them the benefit of the doubt, you know? And that was a mistake to trust the government, you know?
The job was a perfect job for them, and they loved that kind of environment. Maybe if it had been a white person, they most probably would have stood up and said, well, I'm not spraying this, this doesn't smell nice, I'm getting a rash, I'm getting sores, I'm not touching this anymore. Well, they wouldn't, they didn't want to lose their job.
After years of spraying, Mr. Hunter became so ill that he could no longer work and was often bedridden. He had sores all over his body, respiratory problems, dramatic weight loss, and extreme fatigue.
His black arms were dyed white, or bleached white, where that poison came in contact. He had great big lumps under his jaw, from his glands, under his arms, and he told me in his groin. His general health was so bad that he couldn't get up the stairs at work to get his pay.
At 33, Mr. Hunter died in his sleep. He was the first of the Kimberley men to die, but others soon followed.
How many of those men are still alive?
Not very many, and if any, they're sick. Sick today.
Mainly headaches at the moment, yeah.
For more than 30 years, Carl Drysdale has been fighting to get workers' compensation for the surviving men.
Kept me awake all night last night.
When you're going to see
the doctor?
Carl himself has not been able to work since 1985 because of a range of illnesses he believes were linked to the spraying. His wife Marion has had to support him and their four children.
Carl has suffered from just about everything you can suffer from, and I've seen the physical decline in this powerful, energetic man since he finished with the APB.
I had like constant heart attacks unconscious. They told my wife I was going to die over and over again. 5 black spots on my lungs. I've used cortisone cream for rashes that's ruined my bones.
Okay. And you just hold it level with your heart there. Okay.
Dr. Randolph Spargo was a local GP and saw many of the sprayers, including Carl Drysdale.
So it's definitely abnormal, Carl, but much better than used to be.
Have you got any doubt all these years later that it was the chemicals that made a lot of these men sick and in some cases killed them?
No doubt about it. I wouldn't go near that herbicide.
The herbicides were contaminated with dangerous dioxins. Chemical Industries Kwinana in Perth imported some of these chemicals, which were supplied to the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board.
According to the normal toxicity...
In 1978, Four Corners reporter Andrew Ollie interviewed the owner, the late Robert Telford.
But it's not a commercial problem.
What do you mean it's not a commercial problem?
It's because it's not possible for a person using commercial 245T containing these minute infinitesimal quantities of dioxin to be poisoned by them.
How do you know that?
The toxicity becomes meaningless in the dilution.
A few years later, Professor Ben Salinger, a former head of chemistry at the Australian National University, traced some of the chemicals to Singapore, where one batch had been fire damaged.
The normal herbicide would have been light in colour and fairly fluid. The sample we had from the tariff board was clunky and black, so it would appear that there was a good chance they were using the stuff that we also looked at.
All of a sudden, at least 30, 44-gallon drums of concentrate arrived, and it was completely different to the stuff in the 20-litre drums. The stuff in the 20-litre drums was like engine oil and or honey, you know, colour. And the next lot came, it was black and thick, and it blocked up all the nozzles. And 30 drums was enough for at least 20 years.
Tests on a sample of the fire-damaged chemical later revealed it had 200 times the allowable level of dioxin then, and more than 2,000 times the levels permitted in later years.
Well, I think it would have been very dangerous. It was much higher than what was used in Vietnam. And at those levels, I think they were really exposed to a high level of risk.
The men continued to die.
They die with that sort of lingering question mark hanging over, why has this happened to me, you know? And to see that is terrible.
In 2001, occupational work specialist Dr. Andrew Harper was asked to investigate if the men's illnesses were linked to chemical exposure. Dr. Harper says the government's Agriculture Protection Board repeatedly failed in its duty of care.
One, they were not trained. Two, there wasn't an induction program. The information about the risk was not given to them. The supervision was not there. And they were not given, in the main, safety equipment. So they simply went out in shorts and shirts and thongs, and that was it. And there wasn't any systematic washing after exposure. So they were just completely exposed. And the authorities didn't take a responsible stand to, in fact, correct the situation.
Dr. Harper recommended all those who were sick be considered for compensation.
I recommended that compensation be considered, as I felt there had been a disservice done to these people. And it wasn't only manifest in a specific illness, which was difficult to define. It was manifest through the way they were treated and through the impact that that had on their lives and on their feelings of alienation.
But the West Australian Labor government responded to Dr. Harper's recommendation by calling for another report.
Asking for a scientific study created a distraction from the content of my report.
That the men be compensated.
That the men be compensated. It diverted attention away from all of the injustices of the whole program. It diverted attention away from the suffering that these people had, and it diverted attention away from the moral issues that the whole thing exemplifies.
Former Agricultural Minister Kim Chance commissioned the new report.
Harper's report took us a long way. because we began from a situation where we were trying to uncover the results of an event that occurred 20 years before. Harper's report allowed us to tie those events together. He said, look, it looks like there's a cause and effect issue here.
He was a lot stronger than that. He recommended that you consider compensation for all those men.
Yes.
He found a failure of duty of care by various governments.
Yes.
He found that there was no protective clothing, that these chemicals were suspected of being incredibly toxic, and no training. Why did you need statistics to compensate the men when you had all that before you?
Because our means of compensation is the WorkSafe principles or the WorkCover principles. That's the only means we have of compensating a former government worker.
I'd like to get a jar of that poison and pour it down some of those politicians' mouth. Let them see how they feel about it.
The new report recommended only men with cancer be eligible for compensation. 10 years later, only 8 men have received workers' compensation.
To effect what Dr. Harper wanted us to do required a change in the law.
Well, why didn't you change the law?
Well, that's a matter for the whole of government to deal with. That's way beyond the authority of the Minister for Agriculture.
Dr. Randolph Spargo said the men were actually poisoned.
Yes, they were. They were. And they were told that the chemical that they were using couldn't possibly hurt them.
In fact, they were told it was so safe they could drink it.
They could drink it.
I mean, given all that, do you now, all these years later, find it hard to reconcile that they were never compensated, not the great bulk of those men who got sick?
Yes.
If you could...
And indeed, I'll go further than that. I think Dr. Harper's recommendation was the right recommendation.
You're getting a rash on there too. There's all red on that side.
Despite this admission, nothing is likely to change for the children and partners of the sprayers, who believe they are now affected.
Slowly.
3 years ago, Nigel Sinclair was diagnosed with leiomyosarcoma, which is growing on a muscle at the back of his liver. Studies have linked soft tissue sarcoma with toxic exposure from Agent Orange, which was equal parts 245T and 24D.
Just battling to get up and walk around now. Just finding it hard to get out of bed and that, and had to get a new bed now, so... Yeah, and now I'm more confined to a wheelchair. Put my shirt down now.
No mother wants to watch their son deteriorate like this, and it's something that can't fix, you know? Can't kiss it better, can't put a Band-Aid on it, and I've just got to watch him. And I don't like to. Got to try and keep strong.
More than 3 decades ago, when Sue Sinclair was pregnant with Nigel, she used to wash his father's chemical-drenched clothes. After Nigel was born, she would put his nappies in the wash with his father's work gear. And Nigel would crawl all over his father and his swag.
Horrible to think that I might have passed something on to my son. I'd take that away from him any day and put it on myself.
If dioxin was present, the residual level of dioxin in the clothes need not be very high to be potentially harmful. And these chemicals have got the potential to damage genes and produce an adverse effect in the next generation. And this is a real concern.
Of the 77 workers Dr. Harper interviewed, 58% reported having fertility problems, stillbirths, and premature births. There were 12 reports of birth defects.
Some of the blokes have described what their children look like, and I won't even say what they've said about their own children, what they look like. And
why? What was
they look
wrong?
Like monsters, you know, like because of the deformities that they had.
Back in 1976, on the other side of the country, in the small rural town of Yarram in Victoria's Gippsland, a cluster of birth defects was found by a local GP. Dr. Rod Guy told Four Corners he believed the deformities might be linked to heavy spraying of 245T and 24D.
Well, we made a list of the abnormalities, the problems we'd had.
I'd had some really awful things happen, which were really unusual. A baby born without a brain, a baby born without kidneys. Now, in general practice, it's unusual to have serious birth defects.
The Victorian government held an inquiry in 1978.
The disappointing thing was that I thought that the inquiry was really very superficial and, I think, to be honest, rushed to get a political answer.
The inquiry dismissed concerns that the chemicals were potentially dangerous and found that the cluster of birth defects in Yarram could have happened by chance. 2 years later, Professors Ben Salinger and Peter Hall found that there were serious statistical errors with that finding.
Peter Hall is probably one of Australia's best statisticians, and he did that work and showed that the way they did their comparisons would have minimised anything showing up. And when he redid the work using their data, he showed a very high and strong correlation.
So in other words, they were saying that there wasn't a disproportionate number of birth abnormalities.
That's right, yeah. And his results showed that there were a very high proportion of birth abnormalities.
The lies.
Humans have damaged the environment perhaps more than any other species, but there are always some who go out of their way to help animals in distress. Juan Carlos Rodriguez and his wife run a sloth rescue center in the lush outskirts of the Venezuelan capital, Caracas. They have so far saved over 45 sloths. The couple decided to start helping the furry mammals last year after running into a sloth that had been badly injured. They saved him and called him Chewie, after a character in the popular Star Wars franchise. Juan and his wife are now alone in their life-saving journey. Sorry, are not alone in their life-saving journey, as their vet friends also help them with services and donations. The coronavirus pandemic has disrupted lives all around the world, but it's important to try to stay fit for humans and animals alike. Penguins in an open zoo in Thailand have been keeping their daily routines, although no visitors are allowed due to COVID-19 restrictions. They are regularly taken out of their air-conditioned enclosure so they can enjoy a walk or swim. The 41 flightless birds consume nearly 25 kilograms of fresh fish each day. The cute animals at the zoo are aged from 1 month to 18 years old.
Last year, a powerful explosion in Beirut turned life around for thousands of Lebanese. Now, a number of people have decided to build a monument in honor of the victims of the terrible accident. 27 individuals and organizations have pooled their efforts to build a giant 25-meter sculpture at a site of last August's explosion. The artwork is called Gesture and is made out of reclaimed metal debris. It looks like it's handing a flower to the city of Beirut. When completed, Gesture will also have a water and light installation. The project was conceived and designed by Nadim Karam, one of Lebanon's most celebrated artists. South Korean medical workers manning drive-through coronavirus testing centers have a new way to cool off and rest amid hot summer days, recovery buses. The medical workers are now able to enjoy their breaks at these buses, which are equipped with air conditioning, cold water, and snacks. The workers are allowed to take off their protective suits that trap heat and create an environment difficult to tolerate. Some of the buses also have shower booths and bunk beds to help the medical workers deal with their hard work. They say the buses are refreshing.
I almost feel like I'm stuck in a heat dome, like in a car with the air conditioner off in the middle of summer. It's so hot that it's even hard to breathe. But when I come here during the break time and rest in a much cooler and more pleasant environment like an igloo, I can recharge and work cheerfully in the afternoon.
These buses were first designed and used as resting places for Korean police officers and firefighters. Now, 22 of them are deployed to testing centers across the country. The government is considering deploying more recovery buses amid rising temperature and a new wave of coronavirus infections.
An aquarium in the French capital, Paris, is celebrating the birth of a baby black-tip shark. The female shark is 55 centimeters long and weighs 560 grams. She's currently quarantined in a small pond so she wouldn't come under attack by adult sharks. Officials at the aquarium say she'll be ready to swim amongst other sharks in 3 to 4 months. She was born last week at the aquarium, an event the caretakers say is very rare.
It's a rare event for us, which hadn't happened here for the past 5 years. The birth is quite rare in aquariums and in captivity in general. In fact, there are often embryos that won't survive, or they're sometimes stillborn. That's what makes it a rare event, which also occurs at night. We had the chance to observe it during the day, which allowed us to intervene very quickly, and were able to recover the little one.
The International Union for the Conservation of Nature has designated black-tip sharks as a vulnerable species. It's particularly poached in some countries for their distinctive fins. The marvelous creatures have a torpedo-shaped body and often spin out of water while eating. They have specialized cells in their snouts that detect the electric current of nearby prey.
A Turkish farmer hails the miraculous survival of two baby goats from deadly wildfires. Sergeant Bayat said seeing his livestock threatened by flames was the most difficult moment in his life. Bayat said although he lost 8 of his animals in the fire, he found new life after the survival of a newborn goat. He said the mother of the kid had been killed in a wildfire. Bayat called it a miracle. But there was also another baby goat.
We found another goat amidst a wildfire. She has a baby. There you go. Miracle number 2.
Bayat says although his farm was severely damaged, he's now over the moon at the survival of the baby goats. The massive forest fire in southern Turkey broke out on Wednesday, fueled by strong winds. Wildfires are common in southern Turkey in the summer, but local authorities say the latest fires have covered a much bigger area.
Cats are notoriously volatile animals, as we all know. One moment they are purring for your attention, and the next they can't stand being touched. Now, a Canadian firm has come up with an app that can help you better understand your feline friends. The app is called Tabby and works with artificial intelligence. The AI's algorithm was trained at a clinic in the city of Calgary. The developers of Tabby hope their product can be useful for novice cat owners and vets alike. The app can also help monitor the health of cats. Tabby's developer explains how the app functions.
It uses artificial intelligence, so specifically machine learning, and it's coupled with the feline grimace scale. And what the feline grimace scale is, it's a way for humans to be able to determine if a cat is in pain or not based on the ear positioning, the eye positioning, the muzzle, whiskers, things like that. And so we were able to train a machine using machine learning and a series of images to be able to make that determination. So if you're somebody who has a cat but you don't have that training, you can just use the app and it can help you determine this how your cat is doing.
Sounds very useful, but Tabby is not perfect though and runs into problems when trying to decipher the mood of black cats. Despite the hiccups, the developers say the program will get better at doing its task as its artificial intelligence develops through practice.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Humans have damaged the environment, perhaps more than any other species, but there are always some who go out of their way to help animals in distress. Known in Cyprus as Birdman, 28-year-old Konstantinos Antonio is a wildlife veterinarian. Every year, he saves hundreds of sick or wounded wild birds. The animals brought to him are usually found by regular people. Konstantinos says climate change has made the task of assisting birds more urgent as their survival becomes harder and harder. The Cypriot environmentalist usually frees the animals after treatment in the presence of other people in order to raise awareness about the issue. A vertical forest has transformed the Chinese megacity of Chengdu into a concrete jungle, making the lives of the residents greener. Each unit at the 8-tower complex has a balcony with around 20 types of luxuriant plants and greenery. The green space filters air and noise pollution while creating a spectacular view. The project in the southwestern city was completed in 2018, and all of the 826 apartments were sold out at the time.
I think it's quite good. The air quality is pretty good and much better than my old houses. The air is good when you wake up in the morning, and the green trees are good for us elderly people. They are good for our eyes.
Besides all the benefits, the apartments have a major problem. They have been overrun by plants and invaded by mosquitoes. The issue has forced some of the occupants to move out. Other cities around the world, such as New York and Copenhagen, have also launched similar greenhousing projects.
The best visited multimedia exhibit in the world known as Van Gogh Live. The experience has opened in Munich after being postponed a number of times due to COVID-19.
Van Gogh is just the most famous artist in the world. He is also a prototype artist. He is the last artist who then tragically dies at the end. His life story was just fascinating, and that's why he is Van Gogh. And of course, his artworks are fascinating.
Featuring some of Van Gogh's best-known works, the exhibition is not only a feast for the eyes, but the senses with music and smells to accompany the colorful projections. The exhibit is supposed to smell like the countryside because of where Van Gogh lived. However, the organizers say visitors cannot really experience the feeling due to wearing masks. Van Gogh Alive, the experience was first presented in Singapore in 2011. Since then, the multimedia exhibit has been seen in 70 cities and has attracted some 6 million visitors. Conservation measures have managed to bring the world's most endangered cat back from the brink of extinction. In 2002, there were less than 100 Iberian lynx left in the wild. The situation prompted officials in Spain and Portugal to save the animal through a captive breeding program. They also tried hard to fight poaching and reintroduce rabbits, the cat's major prey, into the wild. By the end of 2020, there were over 1,100 Iberian lynx living in the two countries, most of them in Spain's southern region of Andalusia.
The main cause of death for wildlife, certainly in the natural environment, is related to human activities, roadkill, poaching, unwanted encounters. So the less interaction they have with humans, the better.
Despite the successful measures, the International Union for Conservation of Nature still lists the animal as endangered. It's estimated that the species will be out of danger only when its population surpasses 3,000. Urban development, hunting, and roadkill are the major reasons of death for white lynxes these days. Brazilians have come up with a creative idea to combat population, that is pollution and global warming, repopulating mangroves. The project is aimed at reforesting an area equal to 75 football fields in Guanabara Bay. Organizers hope to make the biggest mangrove garden in the country. Mangroves, which usually grow in tropical regions, are essential to maintaining water quality and clarity. They filter and trap sediments, heavy metals, and other pollutants. Mangrove forests are also able to store 3 to 4 times more carbon than other forests.
Tehran municipality has inaugurated an art garden that puts on display Iran's art and culture. As Youssef Jalali reports, the cultural facility aims to reconnect visitors with Iran's rich past amid increasing preoccupation with modern lives.
Sit back and enjoy the beauty of Iran's ancient culture. In Kushk Art Garden, located in the heart of Tehran, visitors get to learn about Iran's music, literature, painting, and calligraphy, far from the hustle and bustle of modern life. Kushk hosts Iranian artists who create masterpieces that have their roots in thousands of years ago.
Miniature painting has been around in Iran since thousands of years ago. In miniature, we paint flat images with a myriad of details. We avoid adding shades to make it as flat as possible, since in the past, Iranians believed that divine light gives shape to everything.
Metal engraving first stepped into existence 7,000 years ago in Iran. It is the art of incising decorations and metals. In this workshop, I will be available every day for visitors to see how I can turn metals into beautiful handicraft.
Kushk is part of a bigger project dubbed Art Garden. The cultural complex consists of an art lake, poem and literature house, music house, and Kushk Garden, each trying to promote an aspect of Iran's culture. Tehran municipality says it inaugurated the peaceful place, for it says cultural identity has been overshadowed by modern technology.
This precious place was a much-needed initiative to preserve the Iranian art and culture. As time goes by, technology gets more and more intertwined with our daily lives, and our genuine culture slips into oblivion. We need to have such cultural centers that safeguard our cultural heritage.
The Art Garden is situated on Abbasabad Hills in downtown Tehran. In recent years, the area has turned into a tourist attraction that houses structures that combine modern technology with ancient culture, such as this large pedestrian overpass called Tabiat Bridge and the Middle East's largest planetarium, dubbed Mina Dome. Kushk will be the last piece of Tehran's Art Garden and will be a hotspot for a range of cultural activities, all aiming to revive the ancient Iranian art and culture, which experts believe have become a lost piece in today's hectic life. Youssef Jalali, Tehran.
IRIB English Radio.